This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in once again for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour today, and our panel of trumpet writers have combed through a lot of news this week to bring you all of the most significant stories, which they're very anxious to tell you all about. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Good to be here.
And joining us via Skype from our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
On last week's episode, we spoke about U.S. President Donald Trump's tour through Europe and just how he had put so much uncertainty and worry into the thinking of many Europeans with his statements about NATO and just his general America First ideologies. And this week, we've been able to see how Europe is reacting. There have been some very dramatic statements made by one European leader in particular that could signal a big shift for the continent. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
That's right. So we talked about the dramatic NATO meeting last week. And then on Sunday, we got Angela Merkel's thoughts on her meeting with Donald Trump. And you know, Angela Merkel is typically very restrained, very thoughtful. She's the type of politician that gives you the impression that she doesn't say anything without having thought about it for half an hour and run it through at least three different focus groups. Now, on Sunday, she was talking doing a campaign event at a beer hall tent in Bavaria, and she said, "The times when we could fully rely on others are to some extent over. I experienced that in the last few days." So a very clear allusion to her meeting with Donald Trump. She said, "We Europeans must really take our destiny into our own hands. Of course, we need to have friendly relations with the US and with the UK and with other neighbors, including Russia. Even so, we have to fight for our own future ourselves." So some really bold and outspoken statements from her there saying, look, we can't trust the United States anymore.
So she's basically saying it's time for Europe to look past this established post-war order, during which Europe has relied on the U.S. for security assurances for so long, and to just sort of go it alone.
Exactly. And then that's something that's been just picked up now throughout the media. Gideon Rachman had a piece in the Financial Times, which we alluded to in one of our trumpet briefs this week, talking about just the dramatic break for Germany. The National Interest had a piece I've got here, is Trump pushing Merkel to create a German superpower. Just talking about the split here. And you look at what's been going on since then, it's just even heightened that split that we saw and that at the NATO meeting and then her talking on Sunday. So we've had more tweets from Donald Trump condemning Germany for its trade policy. And of course, that's something not only are they very sensitive about, because a lot of German economic or pride in their nation has been focused on their economy, but right. It's also just a very practical concern. Half of Germany's economy is exports. About the only growing export market they have is the United States. And so when Donald Trump talks about German exports being exporting all its cars to Germany being very bad, that is something that can mean recession or even depression for the German economy. So there's that. And then we had his pullout of the climate talks yesterday, which is then also something that Germany's kind of taken very personally, because it was the Financial Times that pointed it out, that this is something that all political parties in Germany support and are behind. It's something that's very popular among ordinary German voters, climate change and that kind of thing. So it's had a very direct effect, even what Mr. Trump did yesterday.
So Merkel's up for re-election in a couple of months, and so far it looks like she's doing quite well with her campaigning. And this beer tent event that she was speaking at, as you mentioned, was a campaign event. So how much of this do you think could be viewed as just campaign rhetoric designed to ensure her re-election?
Sure. I mean, it certainly is. It is calculated talk, but at the same time, popular opinion does is always going to play a role in determining foreign policy. And if you have a large percentage of a country that feels a certain way about the United States, that is going to have an influence. It's often not necessarily the determining factor. But then you take a look, and I think George Friedman did a good job of this on his piece that he had for Geopolitical Futures, and you just have a look at, okay, fine, if we ignore public sentiment and just look at interests, you also see a divergence of interests between the United States and Germany. So during the Cold War, you had a common interest. Both wanted to keep the Russians out of Germany. It was an identical interest, so they worked well together. Since the fall of the Cold War, you no longer have this same just identical interest between the two. A lot has kept going just because of inertia. You know, NATO kept going beyond the end of the Cold War. But the United States, you saw after 9/11, was much more concerned with the Middle East. Now they are kind of concerned a bit with stopping Russian expansion. Meanwhile, Germany's core concern is still just keeping Russia out of Germany. And they don't necessarily believe that the best way to do that is confronting Russia. Maybe the best way of keeping Russia out of Germany is to make peace with them and to have a dialogue with them. So there are maybe commonalities in there, but it's not the same solid, identical interest that you saw for decades during the Cold War. So whether you look at Germany's foreign policy just through the lenses of what's being said right now and public opinion, or whether you take a more impassionate view of just common interests, then they both point to a divergence between these two.
So coming on the heels of the NATO and the G7 summits, Merkel's statements really are being widely interpreted as proof of a major breach between Germany and both the U.S. and Britain to a degree. But you mentioned that she's normally very restrained with her speech, but I noticed that if you look at the exact wording of her statement here, it's maybe not quite as dramatic, I guess, as some of those headlines have made it out to be. She said, "The times when we could fully rely on others are, to some extent, over." So those are sort of some big qualifiers and softeners.
Oh, she knew exactly how this would be received in the media. I mean, there's no way that she would have been. Angela Merkel is the great survivor. She is a master politician. I think there are certainly criticisms you can make for her, but just not understanding the implication of her words, I don't think is one of them at all. It's not one I've seen at all. I think she knew exactly what the response would be. And yes, she does hedge it. But I think it's just, we Europeans must really take our destiny into our own hands. That's the kind of the heart of what she was saying, and that was unequivocal. There was no hedging there.
So those qualifiers were well designed, and that was just an expert politician making sure not to kind of overstate the true scope of her sort of anti-American goals.
Exactly. I think it's one of those things that almost like you can give Germans coming away with one message. Okay, yeah, we've broken with Germany. We're broken with America. Angela Merkel's getting tough on Donald Trump. We don't like Donald Trump, so therefore we like Angela Merkel. Woo. That's the message German voters are going to take. But then it does leave her wiggle room on the international scene so that she hasn't burnt all of her bridges with the United States. Sean Spicer can still turn around and quote some of those qualifiers when he's confronted by the U.S. media. Mm-hmm. And she can still move on from here. I mean, nobody's saying that she's going to never talk to the United States again. She knows she's still going to have to work with the United States. So she can still then move on from here and have a working arrangement. I mean, in terms of how much is this statement kind of like something that changes things versus a reflection of a change that has already happened, I think is open to discussion. I think it's more a reflection of a process that Europe has been going through, that has been going through under George W. Bush, under Barack Obama, now under Donald Trump. So it's not necessarily her marking a dramatic shift as much as, or creating a dramatic shift, I should say. It's not as much her creating a dramatic shift as acknowledging and responding to a shift that has been taking place over several years.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. President Trump is now back at home in the U.S., and yesterday he made good on one of his campaign promises that many people both inside and outside of America were hoping that he would have forgotten about. And that was what Richard mentioned there, the decision to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. This just ignited a whole firestorm of debate. It's being seen by some as an assault on the most sacrosanct issue of our age. Some are even saying that it ranks up there with the worst decisions in American political history. But then others are saying that this was the right thing to do, not just for the United States, but even for the global environment. To tell us about this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yes. Well, yeah, President Trump announced in a speech yesterday that we would be pulling out, that was his words, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords. And there is some debate over whether you can actually pull out of the accords, seeing as that this is basically an international treaty that President Barack Obama had gotten America into in December 2015. But since he never actually took the time to get this ratified by the Senate, we weren't actually ever in this agreement in the first place. It was just kind of something that the Obama administration said we'd try to do, and now the Trump administration saying we're not going to try to do. And for those unfamiliar with it, it's basically an international, non-binding international agreement signed so far by 195 nations to either cut carbon emissions or carbon intensity, which carbon intensity would be like carbon emissions per unit GDP. So you could actually emit more carbon. I think China's doing this. They actually emit more carbon, but as long as your economy is growing fast enough that it's less carbon per unit GDP, you're in agreement with this.
So what would the logistics of exiting this deal be? Like, is it as easy as just President Trump saying we're out? Or is this just the beginning of what would have to be a very long process to formally pull out of this deal?
No, like I said, it was a non-binding agreement. The Senate never ratified it. It is just as easy as President Trump saying we're out. We hadn't ratified it yet anyway. So this is something that basically the only thing it pledged to do was to try to, like I said, cut those carbon emissions per unit GDP. President Trump said this was going to cost millions of American jobs and cost the government a ton of money. And so he's saying that just without, he said, this is not something that we're going to be, we're not going to bind ourselves to that agreement now. It'll be up to, unless we renegotiate a new agreement, it'll just be up to the individual American laws passed by Congress or passed by the states over what sort of carbon emission caps that we'll have.
I've heard some chatter and analysis just saying that this decision was actually good news for the environment because the Paris Accord is essentially all words and just very little action. It's just one more of these amorphous and unenforceable international climate deals, not very much unlike the Kyoto Protocol and the Copenhagen Agreement. And I've heard it said that this decision to nix it means that a lot of conservative Americans and companies would now even be more on board with various green initiatives just because it would be market-driven instead of driven by this, you know, unenforceable international amorphous deal. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that could well be. Like I said, the Paris Accords, like I said, they were unenforceable. It didn't actually look like it's probably going to do much to cut carbon emissions anyway. It was more about the agenda behind it. I mean, back when President Obama first got us into this Accords, our Trump analyst Rob Morley had written an article about it, quoting one of the key officials at the United Nations, saying that the actual agenda behind this Paris Accords is to transform the global economic system that's dominated the world for the past 150 years. I say, okay, well, what is the global economic system that's dominated the world for the past 150 years? And it's, at least in the Western world, that's capitalism. And you're saying that that is something that when you that was the goal, even though this agreement was unenforceable, is if you can get the United Nations to start regulating how much carbon 195 nations can emit, you pretty much have like a pseudo one world government where you've got the economy coming carbon. Almost every industrial process currently admits it. So you've got an international organization that can regulate, centrally plan the economy of all these nations. And like I said, so now getting out of that, even though this particular agreement wasn't unenforceable, is just a really bold statement of American sovereignty that, yes, if we do come up carbon emissions, it's not going to be because the United Nations told us to.
Right.
It's going to be because it's something Congress decided, likely driven by market forces, which so far has worked pretty good. I mean, for as much as you've talked about U.S. carbon emissions, I think we are still we're right, I think, around the 50% mark. About half the nations in the world emit more carbon per unit GDP than we do.
Some are saying that this is an embarrassment for the United States because it essentially cedes leadership of environmental stewardship to countries like China. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
No, that's pretty ridiculous. Just because, I mean, China, I don't know. I haven't been there before, but if you've ever known anyone who's been to Beijing and seen the smog, you can see that China is the exact opposite of a leader in environmental stewardship. It's probably one of the worst nations on the planet for pollution and carbon and other things like that. But one of the real geopolitical things here is just because you've got 195 nations that have signed it, is going to be how are other nations going to react? Like Richard mentioned earlier, Germany is really upset. Actually, the Vatican is really upset. I think that a key Vatican spokesman said this is basically a slap in the face to the Pope, especially after the Pope gifted Donald Trump his book on climate change last week. And so, and there's even some green parties in Europe that were talking about sanctions. And now the European Commissioner for Climate and Energy has got out and said that they're not going to consider sanctions on the United States. But even the fact that that was brought up is interesting, because if President Trump actually takes time to read that book that the Pope gave him and that the Pope wrote, he definitely, Pope Francis talks about that in his opinion, that we need international organizations with the power to impose sanctions to be able to enforce wealth redistribution to poorer nations and to be able to end climate change. And so if you're taking the Pope's ecumenical serious there, I mean, not short term, but long term, I mean, it's that is in line with Bible prophecy to see like a Vatican dominated power bloc rising up in Europe and in Latin America and on all these other nations that will impose sanctions on the nations of end time Israel, America, Britain, Australia, and others. And just the fact that that specter has been raised in the point that the United States going its own on climate change is an intriguing prophetic possibility.
It really is. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. On the show last week, we spoke about some new leadership in Hamas, which is the largest of several Palestinian militant groups, and we discussed the way this could lead to a much closer relationship between Hamas and Iran. And now here we are just a few days on from that, and suddenly there's some very compelling evidence that Hamas and Iran are close partners once again. To bring us up to speed on this development, we'll go to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it's interesting you led with that, because it seems like one of the stipulations, or the main stipulation that we can, at the least has been revealed to the public, of the relationship continuing between or rekindling between Hamas and Iran was this, was ensuring that a certain leaders did, or certain leaders did come to the fore over Hamas. They had to be very pro-Iranian leaders, and that's what we got with Ismail Haniyeh last week, or a couple of weeks ago, I think it was now.
Right.
So we had that, his election or his appointment to be the head of Hamas. And then soon thereafter, we had Iranian figureheads showering praise, Iranian leaders showering praise on Haniyeh and Hamas. And then it comes out just this past week that for the past couple of weeks inside southern Lebanon, you've had the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, Hezbollah, and Hamas all negotiating a renewed strategic alliance between themselves, or at least accepting Hamas back into this group to receive funding back to levels that it hasn't received since back in 2012, 2011. And they came out of these weeks-long marathon talks with this relationship, which is something akin to what we saw in the early 2000s.
And how long do you think it would take for this Iranian, just this sort of rapprochement and this increase in Iranian funding to kind of make its way to Hamas? And how soon do you think that that would translate into something like attacks on the Jewish populations?
I don't know. I don't really know if that's going to be their strategy straight away. I mean, Iran has tried that. Numerous wars from the Gaza Strip have been funded from by Iran. They've tried to send shipments of arms to the Gaza Strip so that rockets could be fired against Israel. But I really think that Iran is choosing their time right now to grow closer with Hamas because they have bigger goals than just firing rockets from Gaza. I think they have their eyes on the West Bank. Right now, Syria is being fragmented. And the southern portion of Syria, it looks like, has been divided up to ensure that the Syrian regime stays in power. You've got Iranians that are trying to be the guarantors of that, saying that we will send in our peacekeepers into Syria to make sure nobody breaks this, and they'll be guaranteeing the peace in the southern areas of Syria. And so we've seen Iranian commandos on the Golan Heights even. And I feel like their sponsorship of Hamas, their renewed sponsorship of Hamas, is part of this strategy to really destabilize Israel from the other side, from the West Bank, from northern on the Golan Heights, rather than just from Gaza. Israel has Gaza locked down pretty good. Mm-hmm. They've got a naval blockade. It's going to be very difficult for them to get arms into the Gaza Strip. We know that Egypt is doing their part right now to ensure there's no arms smuggling into the Gaza Strip. So I think this is, while people might say, well, it's a return to what it was like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they did have the arms, the missiles to fire into Israel, but they weren't that effective. The Iron Dome shot them down, not a big deal. I think this is kind of more of a game changer just because they're just in a much more powerful position, Iran is, through its proxies, to destabilize Israel from the north and from the east rather than just the Gaza Strip.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we're discussing on the program today are on the website, thetrumpet.com, or they will be up there very soon if they're not yet. Brent has written an article about that last story along with Callum Wood. The article is called Iran and Hamas Are Back Together. I would encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and check that out and to just get more information about these other stories that we're discussing. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story from a country that's in the headlines more and more lately because of its defiance, its unpredictability, and its illegal weapons programs, and that is North Korea. For an update on what's been happening on the North Korea, on the front there, for an update on what's been happening on the Korean Peninsula and how it's affecting the surrounding region, we'll go to Anthony Chibadidwe.
That's right. North Korea has dramatically stepped up its testing and development of ballistic missiles. It seems like it's been going on every week now. And of course, that has been raising a lot of fears that it could very soon be able to place a nuclear warhead on those ballistic missiles, and they could be capable of hitting Hawaii or even the continental United States. It's getting a lot of people very edgy about it, and frankly, it's been getting it pretty hard to keep up with some of these ballistic missile tests. I think they had one on Sunday, another one on Monday, mm-hmm. and after the one on Monday, the leader of North Korea said that Kim Jong-un promised to send a bigger gift package, those were his words, a bigger gift package to the United States. So it's becoming harder and harder to predict what's coming next. Is it going to be a bigger missile? Is it going to be tipped with nukes? It's hard to tell. And nations are getting ready for that. The United States now has a very strong presence in the Sea of Japan. It sent the USS Carl Vinson and the Ronald Reagan carrier strike groups. And they've been joined there in the Sea of Japan by two ships from the Japanese Self-Defense Force. So you're seeing Japan getting involved a lot more involved there in the region. The two ships that the Japanese send include one of its four helicopter carriers. So here you're seeing a lot of concern in the region. The United States and Japan, they conducted military drills in the region. They began on Thursday, and they'll be going on for 3 days. So this is a problem that Japan is trying to react to. A military spokesman for Japan said this: "It's the first time we've exercised with two carriers. It's a major exercise for us, and it's all because of what the North is doing in the region. It's provoking a lot of nations. It's agitating a lot of nations. It's terrifying a lot of countries, not just Japan, not just the United States, but obviously South Korea. It has been deploying a defense system in March. It has been working on that. Japan has also been reported to be working on a missile shield." That's from an article in Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. Australia is also trying to do the same thing. So
a lot of nations are taking this threat very seriously. I know that the United States has actually just deployed a third aircraft carrier toward North Korea, which really makes it look like this is going to be something beyond just a show of force. There are a lot of analysts, including George Friedman at Geopolitical Futures, saying that this means a U.S. attack on North Korea is actually imminent right now. Do you have any speculation about that? Do you think the U.S. will possibly wage a preemptive strike? And if so, what would a strike like that look like? And what do you think the effects might be?
Well, in the same article that you referenced by George Friedman, he also said that, the United States is also a little concerned about getting involved in the Korean Peninsula.
Right.
It's been there before, and it's very concerned about that. So it's hard to tell exactly what's going to happen. But with all these military developments, you can see that there could be something that could be taking place. But the interesting thing about this development is that there are a lot more nations involved. The United States is cooperating with South Korea and Japan. But China and Russia are getting a little worried about that.
Yeah, both are supportive to varying degrees of North Korea. Really, China and Russia are the only economic lifeline that North Korea has, although both of them are rapidly tiring of their support.
Russia, there's been reports that Russia has been trying to play a role just to mediate between North Korea and the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. But really, Russia doesn't have a whole lot of influence in North Korea.
Right.
It doesn't do a whole lot of trade with North Korea, but China has a better chance at doing that. But China hasn't been doing much, as we know. And China is concerned about the United States trying to lead a military intervention of sorts in the region. A spokesman of the Chinese army, he said this: "If the United States, South Korea, and Japan step up anti-missile cooperation, China and Russia are very likely to ramp up joint efforts to counterbalance the de facto mini NATO in East Asia." So you're seeing essentially an arms race going on because of North Korea.
So you can really see why the U.S. would be reluctant to want to get involved, because who knows which countries would come to North Korea's aid. It could get very messy quickly.
Oh, yeah, it's getting very messy. So even if the North Korea never deploys a nuclear missile, never fires a nuclear missile, there are a lot of problems that this development is causing already.
Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about a new push for unity by the European Commission, President Trump's plan for the American embassy in Israel, China's moves to exploit that growing rift between the U.S. and Germany, and a racial dispute at a U.S. college. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. In the first half, we spoke about German Chancellor Angela Merkel's dramatic statements calling for Europe to be ready to go it alone without relying on President Trump's America. And this week, we also saw the European Commission unveil a bold new plan to greatly boost the unity of Europe and to just fundamentally alter the way the Eurozone is governed. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
That's right. On Wednesday, they put forward their bold new plan or proposal. And so what they called for was basically for a European finance minister and what comes very close to being a European treasury. So at the moment, you have the Eurogroup, which is kind of an informal meeting of Eurozone finance ministers. They called to kind of merge the president of the Eurogroup with the European Commission that's responsible for finances to create a European finance minister. So this is someone that would have quite broad powers. He would sit on both of these groups. I mean, what I mentioned on the Trumpet Daily Radio show earlier today is that the job of Britain's prime minister really evolved out of a very similar job description. So it's easy to see how this, whoever controls the purse strings has a lot of power and could easily become a very important job. Then they also called for basically Eurozone bonds. They wanted to create kind of an equivalent of treasury bonds, but for the Eurozone. And so this would be a way for the European Union as a whole or the Eurozone as a whole to issue debt.
So what would implementation of this mean for Europe and also just for the global economy?
Well, it would be a transition to a superstate. You saw that a lot. These plans are very similar to what Emmanuel Macron put forward when he was running for president, and you saw a lot of people talking about exactly that. And that's what I mean. This is aimed to kind of finally solve Europe's economic crises. Mm-hmm. The aim is to kind of have by 2025 a solution in place, so you stop having these repeats of bailouts and things like that. And it would certainly overcome a lot of the hurdles that are causing difficulties right now.
So it's not really infrequent for us to hear about plans of this kind from EU bureaucrats, but it seems like the talk doesn't always translate into action, at least not as quickly mm-hmm. as we might expect. What about this time? Do you expect to see this plan implemented? And if so, what sort of timetable? Would it be 2025 before anything really happened?
Yeah, that is a good question. I think at the moment it certainly is just talk. And at the moment, Germany has not signed off on this. I don't think even any German member of the European Commission agreed to this paper, for example. Mm-hmm. It's got no agreement from the German government, and Germany's the most important one to get online. So yes, it has a long way to go before its action. But what is important here, I think, is it is the beginning of another round of negotiation. So we're seeing another initiative to try and come up with a solution. Yes, there have been some. You get these initiatives every few years. Yes, they have been shot down in the past. But I think there are some reasons to believe that this time you could get an agreement that works. Now, it's not at all going to be simple to get Germany to agree to this. The main sticking point is this Euro treasury bonds, because it's essentially having a shared credit card. And there is no way Germany is going to share a credit card with Greece unless it's got some pretty strict rules in place that it can have a lot of say over what Greece borrows and how much, to make sure it's not left having to pay off a whole bunch of bills built up by another nation. And so in the past, Germany has not been willing to pay that price. And other countries have not been willing to give Germany that much control over their economy, the kind of control that Germany wants in order to agree to this. Right. And so nothing has happened. This time around, perhaps both sides here would be willing to pay a higher price than they have before. So a few commentators have pointed out now, with everything we've talked about with Donald Trump, how Germany needs the Eurozone to hold together much more. If they want to be able to credibly stand up to America or replace America the way that Angela Merkel's kind of talking about, and talking about, like we read at the start, of Europe standing up for itself, Europeans must really take our destiny into our own hands. Well, that does mean closer cooperation Mm-hmm. So perhaps they'll be willing to go there. And then perhaps other nations kind of feeling like, well, we can't depend on the United States. Perhaps they'll feel a greater need to draw closer to Germany. So I'd say, yes, this is the start of a negotiation, and it could be significant. It could be the one that leads us towards the closer unity. But it requires Germany to make some big concessions, and it requires other nations to make big concessions to Germany.
So it's a very important plan for us to keep an eye on, for sure. Mm. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. In the first half, we talked about President Trump keeping his campaign promise to pull America out of the Paris climate deal. But this week, he said that he will be breaking one of his other campaign promises. And that was his pledge to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. To tell us about what this means for Israel, we'll go once again to Brent.
I think breaking is far stronger than a word that he would use of what he's done. But basically, it's kind of like that. He's at least kicking the can down the road.
Right.
Of course, this was something where he said, and this got in the Jewish vote for sure in America, mm-hmm. at least more than normally goes towards the Republican side in elections. But he said, I'm going to move the embassy. People loved it. He was here last week. He didn't really mention it too much. But now it seems that it's going to be delayed for another 6 months at least. And what we have working in play here is the Jerusalem Embassy Act, which was signed by law by Congress back in the late 90s, which called for the American embassy in Israel to be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, but that being the capital, deemed by Israel to be their capital. And yet there is a clause inside that act that if the situation is dangerous or if it would threaten the United States national security to do this, then the president can waive it for another 6 months and then he can come and look at it. So 36 times this waiver has been signed through President Clinton's time, Bush, Obama, and now Mr. Trump. Seems like he's following the plan of all the others, which is surprising in a way just because of how much emphasis he put on this goal of his in the election campaign.
So this caught you off guard then? Did you expect him to move it?
No, it didn't catch me off guard. And I don't think it caught most people off guard. I think day one in the Oval Office, I was more confident that he would have moved the embassy just because of what he had said. And he generally does try to keep his word, it seems.
Right.
But given his desire for a peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis, the Palestinians came and said, hey, if you move the embassy, it's going to finish us. We're not going to be able to reach a deal. The other Arab states said, don't move the embassy or we're not going to reach a deal. And he is putting this negotiating process, he's giving it a high priority. He wants a deal. And so he decided when he released his press release, this is what he said earlier. I think it was 2 days ago. He said, President Trump made this decision to maximize the chances of successfully negotiating a deal between Israel and the Palestinians. And so he thinks that moving the embassy is going to not create the climate for a deal. The Israelis have the opposite opinion. Like the prime minister over here believes not moving the American embassy perpetuates a Palestinian fantasy that Jerusalem isn't the capital of Israel, which obviously it is. And that should be a negotiating starting point, at least from the Israelis' point of view.
Right. What are your thoughts? Do you think this was the right decision for him to sign one more 6 month waiver and kick the can down the road, or should he have moved it?
Well, I personally feel like it's Israel's I think it's Israel's capital. And so if you normally put, like everywhere else in the world, you put your embassy in the capital. So I don't know. Basically, it seems like he's just following on the course, surprisingly, of all the other American presidents. Bill Clinton said he was going to move it. George W. Bush said he was going to move it. Mr. Mm-hmm. Obama even hinted at it. And all of them, by the end of their 8 years, signed the waiver 8 separate times. So Israelis, after the wonderful visit last week, they're kind of beginning to wonder whether Mr. Trump is such a good of a friend as he said he was.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. All of the stories that we are discussing today, or almost all of them anyway, are published on thetrumpet.com. Please visit there to check these stories out and to subscribe to our free print edition and our free email news briefs. Well, the growing rift between the United States and Germany has apparently caught the eye of the Chinese leadership. Just 1 week after President Trump visited Europe, China's prime minister made his own visit to Europe, and there are indications that China could try to exploit this growing U.S.-German rift to its own advantage. To tell us about this story, we'll go once again to Anthony Chibadidwe.
This development is very tied to what Richard was talking about earlier about Trump's visit to Europe, how nobody was really surprised about what Trump did, because it's something he had been talking about even before he became president. He was talking about pulling the United States out of many different trade partnerships that were not working entirely in the United States' favor. That wasn't anything new. He talked about requiring Europe to do more for itself instead of relying too much on Europe. So that's what he did when he visited Europe. He reiterated some of those points. And of course, Europe was disappointed by that, particularly Angela Merkel. Mm-hmm. And they've been talking, Merkel was talking about how Germany and Europe needs to be more independent of the United States. And so that was the outcome of President Trump's trip to Europe. And now this week you have China's Prime Minister Li Keqiang, who visited Germany on Wednesday for 2 days of meetings with Angela Merkel. And following that visit, the Prime Minister went to Brussels to meet with European leaders. This is part of an annual summit that they have. It's a summit between EU and Chinese leaders that they've been having. This is the 19th that they've been having. So there has been a lot of trade partnerships developing between these two powers. It's been going on for years, but this time around, it's gaining a lot more momentum, primarily because of the United States pulling out. We have so many analysts who have been making comments about this. There's one analyst at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences who said ahead of this meeting that it's an opportunity for China and Germany, as well as the EU, to further strengthen their pragmatic cooperation, since the United States and the EU have recently become more alienated from each other.
Could you quickly just talk about how this fits into the Bible prophecies that we're watching for?
We have talked a lot about a prophecy that talks about a great mart of nations, this trade bloc, mm-hmm, that cooperates and essentially called the shots in global commerce and essentially shuts out the United States. And we're seeing this as a powerful fulfillment of this prophecy. The United States already is trying to pull out of some of those trade cooperation agreements, and you're seeing China and EU trying to take advantage of that. And it's just been exacerbated by even this impasse with the climate agreement, where the United States has been seen as pulling out, mm-hmm, of global commitments, and now it's up to Europe and China to pick up the slack, or so they would think.
So this cooperation between Europe and China will be to the detriment of America's economic power. Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. Well, it'll come as no surprise to regular Trumpet Hour listeners that neo-fascism is rising in the world today. We often discuss signs of those sorts of ideologies emerging in the authoritarian rule of strong men in far-off places like Russia and China and Turkey. But it's not just going on there. The tools of fascism are also being routinely deployed on America's college campuses. And to tell us about this disturbing reality, we'll go once again to Andrew.
Yes. Well, Evergreen State College in Washington State was closed yesterday, and it remains closed today due to a security threat due to high race tensions. And to give you just the background on how this happened, It was actually back in March. One of the student papers made a pretty shocking request. Mm-hmm. They said that they wanted all white students and all white professors to get off campus for a day to create a quote unquote safe space for students of color.
Wow.
Though there was one of the white biology professors refused to leave campus that day and sent an email to the school administrations just saying that he thought that a university should be a place of free speech, a place where all races are welcome, right, and request that a certain racial group leave campus was an act of oppression.
Yes.
And it kind of died down after that, but just last week, the email leaked out and the students found out that he'd said this heinous thing that white people should be allowed on college campuses in the United States. And so they had protests, like 3 days of protest. There's a video that's kind of gone viral. We normally would have included some audio footage on the program, except that it's just so laced with profanity to where every time this white professor tried to speak and defend his opinion, he shouted down and people are yelling him that he's a racist for saying that, for not leaving campus that day and saying that whiteness is the world's most oppressive system, and that some of the students of color saying that their ancestors had invented vast and sophisticated cities when white people were living in caves, and that he needed to get off. And eventually it got so violent, and they had the police received some like threats. They're not saying exactly what the nature of the threats, but like a bomb threat or something of that, where they're saying that now not just white people, but everybody has to been off campus for 2 days because it's actually, they're just afraid that if someone comes on there, just some like horrible act of terrorism is going to happen.
Wow. That is really, really shocking to hear about. Victor Davis Hanson recently wrote about this, and he said that what's happening on U.S. college campuses now often mimics the political street violence of the late Roman Republic. Could you talk a little bit about just the parallels between that ancient historic era and what we're now seeing?
Yeah, I've heard a number of analysts, Victor David Hansen compared to the late Roman Republic, a few others have compared to like Weimar Germany. The fascist reference you made at the beginning, just saying that in like Weimar Germany or Rome, where you just had this political division where political parties against each other and ethnic groups against each other, and you're having this violence take off, which is something that hasn't been seen so much on the streets of just like everyday small town American cities, but on college campuses, this is not something that's unique to Evergreen University. I mean, we've talked on this program before about in Southern California about students linking arms and not letting white students get into classes.
Yes.
It's becoming, I saw something in the Wall Street Journal or maybe it was New York Times about it becoming more and more common for students to hold completely separate commencement activities for students of color. Wow. And in kind of a strange irony, a lot of these minority groups, radical minority groups on American college campuses are actually almost calling for the return of like Jim Crow style segregation, but in reverse.
Right.
To where there was a time in the United States where colleges were segregated, and then we got away from that, and now they're saying like, okay, well, we want this segregation again, but it's now the whites who are not welcome on this campus.
Wow, that is really interesting. Thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit there to read more about the stories that we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out several times each week. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news items from all of our panelists coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last brief look at some of the other big headlines from this week that caught our attention. First, we'll go to Brent.
The command of the Coalition for Supporting the Legitimacy in Yemen, which is basically the Saudi coalition, announced today that a Marshall Islands flag tanker came under attack on Wednesday while passing through the strategic Bab el-Mandeb Strait. The coalition statement said three rocket-propelled grenades were fired at the tanker from a naval boat on Wednesday in between the islands, the Yemeni islands of Mayan and the Djibouti islands of Sabah. This is just the latest attempt by the Iranian-backed Houthi militia to jeopardize trade sailing through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, a 20-mile stretch of land which connects the Red Sea and therefore the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean.
And Andrew.
The United States Conference of Catholics bishops has chimed in on President Trump's 2018 budget proposal, criticizing it for increased military spending and stronger enforcement of border security. A letter from the conference signed by six bishops, including Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York, calls the budget a moral document with profound implications for the common good of our nation and the world, before criticizing its so-called immorality for not letting more immigrants into the United States.
And Richard.
This time next week, Britain could have a communist prime minister. Polls say that the Labour Party might or could have enough votes to form a coalition on the election on Thursday. The leader of the Labour Party has called Hamas and Hezbollah his friends. Their candidate to be in charge of policing and justice says that Mayo has done more good than harm on balance. And the one they want in charge of the economy says he is a Marxist.
Okay, and back to Brent.
Iraqi militias close to the Iranian regime have reached a strategically situated village on the Syria-Iraq border. The popular mobilization units reached the village of Jaris on the border in northwestern Iraq on Monday. This represents a major strategic shift in northern Iraq as the Islamic State loses power and the corridor stretching from the Iranian border to Syria is opened up. This is dividing the Shiites, who are basically a powerful force in the south of Syria, from the Kurds, the powerful force in the north. For Israel, this means that the Iranian-aligned forces pose a risk of linking up through Iraq to Syria to the border with Israel on the Golan Heights.
And Anthony.
A lone gunman in the Philippines attacked a casino in Manila, fired shots, and set fire to gambling tables. 37 people were killed. They died of suffocation. Police ruled out the possibility of terrorism, but that did not stop the Islamic State from claiming responsibility for it.
Okay, and Andrew.
The Trump administration has asked the United States Supreme Court to immediately reinstate its ban on travelers from six countries known for exporting jihadists. This ban was overturned earlier this year by the Ninth Circuit Court. But now that the Supreme Court's at full roster with the confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch, the Justice Department is moving to get this case appealed as soon as possible.
And back to Anthony.
The leaders of China were not the only ones visiting Angela Merkel this week. On Monday and Tuesday, Angela Merkel received a delegation from the Indian government, which included the prime minister. In 2016, China invested over $2.9 billion in Germany. In case that doesn't sound like a lot of money, that was an increase of 258% from the previous year.
And now we'll end with one last item from Richard.
NASA announced this week they're going to launch a probe to, quote, touch the sun. It will launch summer next year. It actually will fly inside the corona or the outer layer of the sun and will come a mere 4 million miles from the sun's surface. It will withstand temperatures above 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit and travel at 450,000 miles an hour.
I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our print edition and our Trumpet Brief. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with the words of Frank Outlaw. Watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. Watch your character, it becomes your destiny. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.